Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is July 2nd. Today we have George Magnus and Ira Harris. George is an independent economist and commentator, research associate at the China Center, Oxford University, and at the School of Oriental and African Studies, London. He was the chief economist at UBS Investment Bank from 1995 to 2012. He's had a front row seat for multiple episodes of boom and bust in both advanced economies and emerging markets, including the great financial crisis of 2008. His book, Red Flags, Why Xi's China is in Jeopardy, was published in September 2018. Ira is independent trader, past hedge fund manager, and global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and a stint also recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Great. I thought we'd begin, George, with your global macro view on the economy and the financial markets.
Thanks very much for having me on the show here. Bird's eye view of the kind of world economy. I mean, it seems so far to have obviously defied some of the worst expectations that were running around maybe earlier this year about kind of imminent recession and so on. Which is obviously good news, and you know the bond markets have by and large tended to kind of pull back from some of the panic mode that they were in when the original reciprocal tariffs were announced in the Rose Garden. Not going to be a Rose Garden for much longer, as I understand it. I don't really see too many signs of balance sheet stress that I normally have, you know, kind of traditionally looked for in looking for kind of turning points in the economic cycle. I mean, it's not like markets are cheap, I think, and it's not like balance sheets are in great shape, certainly not government balance sheets. But I don't really see those kind of telltale signs that tell me that something imminently awful is at hand. Having said that, I think there is a kind of a churn going on in the US economy. I mean, Europe, I'm not particularly optimistic about anyway, but I think in the US economy in particular, and in China, obviously the two biggest economies in the world, I think there's a churn going on in the US economic indicators, which suggests that, you know, economic growth is slowing down. I mean, I'm slowing down to like, not exactly a snail's pace, but certainly, you know, subpar economic growth, which may be consistent with the possibility that rates may come down, Trump notwithstanding, and Fed nominees and so on. And in China, I think that the economy is kind of has been coasting a bit, really, off of the stimulus packages that were announced late last year in sort of September, October time. And I think that without a kind of further action, I think that that China is going to be a bit disappointing in the second half of this year as well. So generally speaking, I think I'm not really kind of manning the, you know, the panic stations about, you know, going into a deep dive. But I think we're losing a bit of oomph, to use a technical term, in terms of economic activity. And I think that'll be consistent with lower interest rates in due course.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And your thoughts, Ira? Do you agree?
Good point. And I think, you know, I'm kind of surprised that the equity markets hold, but not totally surprised. Because if we go back to when MERS made the shift in the European, in the German Bundestag, and on that day, and George, certainly, you know, in this realm, because we saw that day something very interesting we've talked about before, Richard, but the DAX rallied 4% when yields on the Bund jumped 35 basis points. when they did that shift on the budget process. And as I pointed out, it'd be one thing if the DAX had rallied 4% from a trough, but it rallied 4% from all-time highs while yields jumped. So, I mean, it's been riding that wave as we're beginning to see that European exceptionalism can become American exceptionalism. All you do is have to spend a lot more in fiscal stimulus and you can become very exceptional. Who's going to pay for your exceptionalism? Maybe is the answer that we sit at. But with the dollar coming down, and I've been in the bearish dollar camp for quite a long time, and we've got a lot of pushback on these podcasts about it. But I think that's, when you talk, is that going to be a stimulus for the global economy? Because there's so much dollar-denominated debt, especially in the, what are we calling it this week? The global south. I know we've gone from third world to less developed to third world to emerging. Now we're in the global south. But there's so much debt issued in dollars that anytime the dollar, and this has been more than an insignificant dollar sell-off, is that providing the next, and I don't know what the duration of it will be, but will it be the next great stimulus to global growth?
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree that there are kind of little fires of optimism around. That's one of them. Particularly for the emerging countries and middle-income countries. Also, I think the removal of the debt brake, I think, which is the issue that you were referring to in Germany, right. I mean, that's kind of a big deal. I mean, there's a huge kind of discrepancy of opinion, if you particularly in Germany, between those that think that this is the sort of purgatory, you know, which is going to descend upon Germany and Europe because the anchor of, you know, monetary and fiscal stability and the underpinning of the euro is being undermined by this, what people regard as kind of fiscal irresponsibility. And then on the other side, you know, obviously, if anybody has fiscal space to be able to, you know, adopt a more kind of relaxed approach to policy formation, it's Germany, you know, which has it. You know, its debt to GDP is relatively restrained. It probably will rise quite considerably in the next 3 or 4 or 5 years. I don't think I don't think they're going to go overboard with this, but it is something to keep an eye on. I think that's a good point.
So, and then, you know, go back. So I know one of my favorites to watch, may he rest in peace, was Wolfgang Schäuble, who, you know, and the same thing we saw it back then during COVID, right? The big discussion, and what were they going to do with those PEP bonds? How are they going to finance all that? And Schäuble, you know, I think it was in May of 2021, could be wrong, but pretty close to that. And he made that, it was an FT interview, or an FT, yeah, it was an interview with Schäuble, and he made that comment that he was in favor he said, don't give those countries who are really under duress from COVID loans, because he said that would be like putting rocks in their pockets. Do grants, which was threw me for a loop. Here's one of the most conservative voices and strong and sound money people talking about, it can't be done as loans. And the euro took off. I think we went from around 107 to maybe 120. It was interesting because a lot of people were bearish the euro currency. But when Europe does do fiscal spending, especially supported by the German, which are not always in sync, but mm-hmm. I think that does provide a stimulus. And of course, this defense spending, whatever way we want to couch it, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's a pretty important stimulus that will play out to the global economy. So I think this is a good jumping off point to take us to certainly George's recent interview with the market on China. So, and see where that plays out with all of this.
Yep.
Yeah. You recently did an article on themarket.ch entitled, Nobody Can Win This Trade War. But It was more of a focus on China. But before we get to that, just wanted to know your thoughts on the trade issues and challenges between the U.S. and Europe from your perspective.
Yeah, it's a kind of a moving feast because obviously there are some deadlines coming up. I mean, obviously, we don't really know what the legal situation is going to be in the United States about the tariffs, which the Court of International Trade ruled as illegal with a stay of execution. And it is being appealed. And we've got a deadline coming up on July, next week, I think. Certainly for the non-China reciprocal tariffs. So I don't really know whether, I mean, I've been kind of somewhat kind of taken aback, like most people, that, you know, all of these negotiations that the United States was having with Europe and Japan and Korea and India and goodness knows what else, nothing's really happened or been sort of aired so far, I think, except for the UK to some degree. There is a sort of a lot of questions around, really, about whether, you know, the Europeans are going to kind of dig in and kind of retaliate against what might be a reiteration by the Trump administration of higher tariffs on Europe. I mean, certainly there's a bit of movement going on, I think, within the Commission and some of the member states about restiveness about their, you know, there was a point a few weeks or months ago when they thought that China would be the kind of answer to the European trade problems. I think a lot of people now are kind of pulling back from that view and see that that China is actually potentially a problem for Europe, given the speed with which Chinese exports have been redirected towards large numbers of European countries, particularly in areas that threaten kind of industrial strategy at home. I don't know whether, you know, I mean, ideally the US and the Europeans ought to be able to settle, you know, higher tariffs than existed before, but, you know, they won't be going at each other hammer and tongs. But the politics of this are quite difficult to call. So I'd be hopeful that they can reach some kind of an accommodation. But I would say at this point, you know, particularly given the volatility of Trump's iterations, can't really tell which way it's going to go.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Your thoughts, Ira, on the U.S.-Europe trade?
Yeah, first of all, I love this because, you know, and I think back, having read George's work for so long, and I'm an owner since I've been, UBS is one of my favorite holdings, and George's work, especially with his work on Asia, so it all fits in. And UBS, why do I own UBS? Only one reason, because of really George's work in putting them into a really good situation to be wealth managers in Asia. To me, that is, UBS has a great strength. They got away from it because they wanted to be Goldman Sachs and be another hedge fund. But now I think that they've reworked this whole, and they brought in, what's his name, who was at the Bundesbank, who should have been the head of the ECB.
Yeah.
Come on, I'm getting old too, so.
It'll come to me.
Yeah, I know. Who should have been the head, had Merkel not been absolutely worked over by Sarkozy back in 2011, he would have been, this is so bad that I'm not recalling his name, but they are so well positioned for this, and it's so good to see. But I'm looking at, and Asia, and the Trump tariffs are interesting. And I think that the world misses Trump. You gotta get, everything with Trump is a give get. Now he's pressuring Japan as of the last 48, 72 hours, which I found interesting because he's already made a deal with the Japanese by allowing Nippon to basically take over U.S. Steel. You can call it whatever way you want. So that deal's been done, which should lead to more and greater flexibility on everybody's part. But I look at this, and you got to give Trump something. And if you listen to the Trump people, from Bessent, who comes out of our realm, he's a global macro person with great expertise, what are you going to give him? Trump needs a victory for the heartland. The ag sector The agrarian economy in the U.S., and as I'm talking, the soybeans are moving up, but they need something. They were supposed to get it in 1819 with that original deal with the Chinese, that the Chinese were going to import all these grains from the U.S. But its time is now. And I think they're missing, I think the Chinese and the Japanese are both missing something very important here, that you can make a deal. And if you actually will move to import a lot of agricultural stuff from the U.S., you can get Trump. This is just my opinion, but I've just been watching him, that you can get some relief. And I look back on this, and let's see. So it's probably 53 years ago of the great Russian wheat deal, right? Where the Russians really bought all that wheat from the U.S. They bought goodwill with the U.S. And what did they do? They in turn processed that wheat and exported it around the world. And they wound up making a lot of money. American farmers did well. It's time. And, you know, I was going through some things with the Japanese. The Japanese, you could buy up all the soybeans in the United States, reprocess them and sell them to the rest of the world and make money, especially with the yen at 144, because a lot of those companies, but you have big companies that you can, the one I was looking at yesterday quite a bit was, I'm sorry, George may be more familiar with it, but these are ways to play off, and it is. Oh, Kanamatsu. So, and the Chinese could do this, and they were doing it during COVID. The Chinese were buying everything, and you could see it because the yuan actually strengthened when everybody was anticipating that the yuan was going to be depreciated for China to ensure that they weren't going to lose their market share. But China went the other way, and as commodity prices were soft, they were busy buying and stockpiling everything. So I don't know, they may as well, that's an easy give to Trump and you can get a victory. So, so let's see what happens. Let's see what happens on July 9th. There's already some deal announced with Vietnam as we're talking, it just came up on my news feed. So supposedly, we'll hear more from George because he really, I know, has a lot more to say about this.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Yes, if you could elaborate, George, on your nobody can win this trade war, what your thoughts are, the themes that come out of that article that you wrote for The Market?
Yeah, so I think this is possibly, something which a lot of economists kind of coalesce around, really, which is the idea that if the only kind of quiver in your bow, is tariffs, right, to address trade imbalances, what you're going to do is you're going to redistribute the pattern of exports and imports, but you're not going to solve trade imbalances. And I think that's as true today as it was theoretically, before Trump came to office and we were talking about, what he might do in the second administration. So, for example, if you look at Chinese exports to America in the first 5 months of this year, they're down about 36% year over year. But actually, America's trade deficit is not down 36%. It's pretty much where it was or higher. And China's surplus is definitely still rising. So really what's happened is that Chinese exports have basically been redirected through one of three methods or three of three methods. One is through offshoring, which is actually a longer term phenomenon where Chinese companies and also multinational companies in China basically calibrate production facilities in other countries to avoid sanctions and export controls and tariffs and so on. That involves a lot of planning and construction and so on. So it's not something you can do like from one month to the next. But it's been happening since 2017, to be sure. The second method is to do with just kind of redirection of trade, really, where you basically ship something to Vietnam and therefore you just and rebrand it made in Vietnam rather than made in China. And the third really is simply by just doing assembly. For example, like iPhone is, going to assemble their products. Apple is going to assemble iPhones in India, and it'll be branded made in India, but all the components are still coming from China. So through these methods, obviously Chinese exports are just essentially finding their way to the United States or to other countries, but through the recalibration of supply chains. So in that sense, you can't win a trade war through tariffs. It just means that the routes through which exports and imports flow are in constant flux and changing. So we know, for example, that Vietnam, Mexico, Thailand have been big beneficiaries of foreign direct investment inflows and of greater exports to the US, but also other countries in ASEAN. Turkey has been a beneficiary. These kinds of things have become pretty common now. So I think it's a mistake to think for the US administration to think that they can change the US trade deficit simply by implementation of tariffs. Tariffs can have a function. I'm not wholly kind of opposed to the idea of tariffs per se, but I think it has to be done. They have to be used much more on a sector basis, an industry basis, rather than across the board. And I think it has to be done in conjunction with domestic policies that are going to change how trade is effectively determined. Which is, without going into a nerdy explanation, it's really about the balance between savings and investment at home. So if you change those policies, you can change trade imbalances. But if you don't change those policies, you're not going to have any effect. So.
If I yes, I think
Yes,
that I
go ahead.
can't agree more. And again, a lot of it is it's like Trump yelling about the Japanese not importing rice into Japan. It's a silly discussion because rice is holy to the Japanese. If you read Japanese history, and they will protect the rice farmers in the same way in Europe through the common ag policy, which has been a problem for Europe. What they, in order to, placate the French, you had to have the common agriculture, which policy, which protected French farmers. That comes into play, but you can't pick at those types of things because, again, every government in the world, every sovereign has different groups that desire and demand protection. What's his name? Douglas Irwin wrote the beautiful book Clashing Over Commerce about the history of trade policy and it's in the US. And it's a great thing because it's all about that type of development. Nobody develops, without some of that. So I think George's point is dead right. And again, with China. But it's a matter of whether China ever intends to have a greater domestic consumption-oriented economy. I think that makes them a little bit different than what we've seen through the classical types of development versus what seems to be a more mercantilistic approach that certain, especially Asia, has built. And Japan was really the model because Japan did it very well. And we saw in the 70s and 80s, I mean, their products were far superior, but when under duress, they were willing to produce and make very little profit to protect market share. And that's, I think, a big part of of the different mindsets. You know, the mercantilist mindset, I will protect my market share. And I think China looks upon that as, yes, that's somewhere we can go. But I think George's points are all well taken. And how are we going to get out of some of it? And I'm with him. Tariffs will work. If you want to send a message, and it does, you know, and whatever you want to say about Trump, all his bluster and the threats, it does get your attention, and at least you begin discussions. So rather than everything blowing up, have a discussion. And can we do this better? And where's my give get?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Ara. I see. And something that probably just needs, I'd like to kind of emphasize a little bit myself, which is really, even though I think we can have this discussion about whether tariffs are effective or not, or what sort of tariff regime and system might have some positive effect, the reason we're here in the first place, you know, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, people kind of throw the focus and the spotlight onto Trump and, you know, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Trump. That's not strictly speaking true, because the Biden administration was, I mean, it carried on Trumpian policies in a different kind of form. And so, not, you know, it's kind of, things have changed, but also they haven't changed, because the whole emphasis really of the US administration, but increasingly other countries as well, is really a demonstration to, or a kind of an expression to Beijing, which is, we do not accept anymore, we cannot accept anymore, that your mercantilist system, in which industrial policy, supply, production, export, capacity, all of these things are basically being thrust onto the rest of the world. And it has a cost, which is not just being felt in the US, kind of Ohio and, you know, kind of the old kind of Rust Belt states, or, you know, Detroit and so on and so forth. But also, if you look at the actions of countries like Brazil, Indonesia, Malaysia, India, Thailand, where whose automobile industry is being kind of crucified by not just by Chinese imports, but I would say more recently by Chinese imports. I mean, all of these countries have raised so-called trade defense measures against the Chinese for dumping or for threatening with cheap imports their domestic industries, whether they be steel or textiles or low-value manufacturing in Indonesia's case, higher value in Malaysia's case. And so this is becoming a very kind of common phenomenon, this pushback against China's economic model. So although we all have, you know, really negative things to say about, you know, the way in Trump's tariffs policy has been administered, and it's on again, off again, on again, off again, and the implementation has been pretty poor, I think it's important not to lose sight of the reasons that we're in this space in the first place, because actually we're not going to solve it unless we can somehow, you know, get on top of that issue.
And to that end, the big question is, will the U.S. plan and these other countries, as you mentioned, George, that have these tariffs in place with the hopes that domestic industries can improve and come up to speed, perhaps globally competitive. What do you see as the success of that, given challenges of the need to educate your resources, the need to refine or do a rehaul of all of the regulations that are either prohibiting development or restricting development, regulatory capture, for example, all those challenges, which take time, right? You can't have this happen overnight.
Right.
What are your thoughts?
Well, there is quite a rich history of tariff policies. I mean, certainly in the United States, but for other countries as well, and particularly for emerging and developing countries, in which, you know, I mean, the IMF was Even the IMF, has kind of acknowledged that there are kind of circumstances in which, it might be appropriate to protect or to give protection to certain industries, to give or at least to certainly to buy time, while production facilities and resources are kind of built up to develop a kind of a capacities in producing stuff, which otherwise might not happen. So I do think it's quite difficult, I think, to draw a kind of a general conclusion and say it's either good or it's bad. I think it's kind of horses for courses. I mean, I certainly think in the case of the United States and Europe or other developed markets, it's a kind of a fantasy to think that protection will actually bring low-value manufacturing and cheap labor back to our countries. That's just not going to happen. We are not going to, resurrect. Although, let's take Germany as a case in point, where obviously the car industry has a huge problem on its hands with, cheap Chinese electric vehicles, or cheaper Chinese electric vehicles and batteries now. I mean, Germany's car industry is not going to reconstitute itself by raising barriers so that they can produce traditional Mercedes and Porsches the way that they have done for the last 25 years. That's gone. That's just not going to happen. So the idea, I think, in theory, is that you might be able to offer temporary protection to some of your producers or some of the kind of industries within some of these, sensitive sectors, so that they can develop modern manufacturing. Won't be labor generating, because modern manufacturing is going to be robotic, it's going to be AI, it's going to be all this kind of stuff, but it will give you the capacity to do things that you can't maybe do as cheaply now. Obviously, it addresses in some areas things like national security, which is now much more broadly defined. And I think, we have to think about trade and tariffs and export controls in this context as well. I mean, Ira mentioned before about Nippon Steel's kind of takeover or permission to take on US steel. Is it a good idea, for the Americans to try to produce steel at the same cost as the Chinese do it? They're never going to do that. It's just not going to happen. But actually, it may not be completely dumb for the Americans to be less reliant on Chinese steel imports for certain types of activities that they may have to be able to, or they may be able to define, either in terms of, military technology or certain types of, kind of dual fusion use, civilian military usage, and so on. So, I think it is a horses for courses thing. Sometimes we are going to throw, good money after bad. I don't think there's any question about that, because companies will use their lobbying prowess and powers, to garner special favors from taxpayers and from the government. But that doesn't mean that all pleading is can be dismissed like that.
Yeah, that's very interesting considerations. Your thoughts, Ira? Do you think the AI will be able to help on that with the US?
Again, you listen to George talk, and I listen, I hear Keynes in so much of the thought process. I close my eyes, I listen to the voice, I go, yeah, maybe I should be up in the White Mountains. But more importantly, the point he makes about the German auto industry, right? And I remember I was shocked when I first saw the numbers early in the year that China became the largest auto exporter in the world. That was mind-boggling in some ways, because you don't think about it. You think about, them building for the domestic market. Who thinks about, when's the last time you've seen a Chinese vehicle on the streets of New York or, wherever you live at? You don't. So it was kind of more than interesting. And the way the Germans mucked up the diesel issue, but they're right. They're at this point. George is dead right. I mean, and this is Schumpeter, right? This is, in the essence, creative destruction. These are entrepreneurial, and you better make the entrepreneurial changes. And as we're talking about what's coming next week, Musk is absolutely dead right on here on this. And I hate this tax bill. I hate it. I don't know how to we I it's they're all derelict, because they just want to get a bill passed. And when Musk takes them to task, that there's a lot of subsidies in here for older established businesses to keep them going. He said, and that's just, you know, Germany, as George White, cannot get into that, which is why you can be, I'm bullish certain entities in Germany thinking, well, they're going to benefit, especially from defense spending, because there's a lot of collateral outcomes from defense spending. I mean, the U.S. is all about that. Go back to the 50s and 60s, the story of Hedy Lamarr, you know, with, you know, you get all kinds of fallout, the Cold War and all the research done at RAND and AT&T and led to all types of things in the economy. So you're better off supporting nascent developing industries than going backwards. Because if they can't stand on their own, if you're a good capitalist, goodbye. Goodbye. I mean, you know, I'm a Schumpeterian. It's, you know, I combine Marx and Schumpeter, you go a long way in this world because you understand the debt and the entrepreneurial spirits. But Germany, and I think that's George, is really at a cross-cutting point. Now, can BMW, Volkswagen, Mercedes, do they have the wherewithal? No question. And if they decide to go to the hybrid model, they'll do very well. They're going down the electric, but they can't sell enough. And, you know, and I think that's Musk's point. And they're going to pull the subsidies out from Tesla, right? But I think that benefits Musk, because we saw what he did back in 22 and 23 when he cut prices on the lower end, you know, because he was worried about BYD, but he cut prices to move inventory. And he went, you know, as I checked recently, from 30% margins down to 20%. He can exist. I'll tell you who won't exist. Say goodbye to Rivian, say goodbye to Lucid, Ford and General Motors EV programs are going to become under threat because Musk has the ability to outprice them in the short term. If he goes to a mindset like the Chinese and the Japanese and say, you know, I'll live with less profitability, but I'll maintain market share, maybe grow market share, even without those subsidies. So I think people have to be really careful throughout this. But George's point about the Germans, and I think Germany is the place to watch, by the way, especially as they now will get some of these businesses that may have been affected negatively will start getting some defense contracts, which will be able to them to ramp up and recover from some of the mistakes that they've made.
So where do we go, George, after July 9th? There was a pause in the tariffs. How do you see this playing out post July 9th, and also effects on the economy in terms of potential rising inflation from tariffs?
Okay, I think the honest answer as we speak here on the 2nd of July is I don't know. I mean, I read something that was attributed to whether Trump said it in a press conference or on Truth Social, I'm not sure. Which is that the tariffs won't be rolled on the 9th of July, but, you know, that if there are no agreements in place, then they'll revert to what they were. I mean, I think we've all learned by now that, you know, that we kind of listen to Trump literally, but not necessarily always seriously. So, you know, is that just a kind of a bluster just to get some countries to try to agree something before the week is out? Or I don't know. I mean, if the reciprocal tariffs were restored to what they were before the 90-day pause, and they were eventually to be declared legal, I think that would be bad news. I mean, it would. So far, there's not been a huge increase. I mean, sorry, let me just kind of backtrack a minute. The tariff shock should be, you know, a supply problem for countries that are implementing tariffs, like the US, and it should be a demand shock for everybody else that's on the receiving end. And so far, we haven't really seen those shocks, you know, in stark form. So if you take the United States, there's been next to no pickup in inflation that one can attribute to tariffs. If you look at China, I mean, exports are booming. I mean, obviously, a lot of this has to do with the timing and people, you know, front running announcements or, you know, catching up afterwards, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe the first 6 months or 7 months of this year, not enough time has kind of elapsed. But I think if we went back to the reciprocal tariff levels that prevailed before the pause, I think, yeah, I think the implications for global growth and for inflation in the US and for China would be much worse. So my base case is still that by and large, even though some countries may be, you know, may face higher tariffs on the 10th of July, my base case is that they probably will be extended, but we'll see what happens.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira, base case?
I agree totally with that. And by the way, yeah. I may interject, the one we were thinking about was Axel Weber, who is right, who's sitting in a very nice position at UBS, which always keeps me, just like I feel the same way about Commerce Bank, you know, but Jens Wiedemann sitting on the board as the risk, you know, to manage risk, gives me the, you know, these are places that I love, just, you know, so. But base case, yes. And again, China could help itself if they would, and I know George has talked about it over years, and Pettis, you know, they do have to change the structure of their economy. The world is not going to let them sit there and eat everybody's lunch all over the world. Yes, they're in a great situation. Yes, they're building out the road, Belt Road Initiative. But they're going to have to be more of a consumer than they have let on and have wanted to be. And I understand Xi's fears. They need a little bit more of the Deng Xiaoping leadership where he's willing, but of course he was following in a much different path in a different time. But I think these would go a long way to at least easing some of the stress points. That's all. These are stress points, and they're even in Asia, you know, where they're, the Japanese have plenty of concerns.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, but I'm not very optimistic that such a change is going to happen while Xi Jinping is still in power. So, I mean, you know, if you look at since 2022, so since the end of COVID, I mean, the volume, okay, the values of Chinese trade exports and imports have been kind of distorted a little bit because of price deflation. But if you look at the volume of Chinese exports since 2022, they're up by about a third. And the volume of Chinese imports is like flat. They've hardly changed. And so we wouldn't have this problem with China. I mean, nobody, not the United States and not anybody would have this problem with China if they were true free traders, you know, if they imported as substantially as they exported, everybody would be happy, I think. But the fact of the matter is that the government is so pledged and committed to this idea of winning the fourth industrial revolution, elbowing aside the United States and other developed markets in that process, and basically championing the role of export of Chinese exports and Chinese industrial modern industry in the world economy and governance. I mean, so committed to that view, I don't think they make noises and they have a rhetoric which is about we need to do something about domestic consumption. I actually don't think they really want to go that route, because once you transfer economic power to citizens and private firms, implicitly you're transferring political power as well. That's just not going to happen under Xi Jinping. So I think that pushback that you referred to, Ira, you know, in where lots of countries are just not going to be happy to allow open-ended, you know, blank checks for Chinese imports, I fear that's going to get a lot worse in the next 2 or 3 years rather than better. And whether the rest of the world can force or persuade China to change tack, I'm doubtful. So I'm not really very optimistic about how this all ends up.
Yeah, that's a very good point on the potential for that transfer of political power. And your thoughts, Ira, on that? Or
well, I mean, listen, political power, it's not, we're not, this is just not a talking point. This is very real in China, right? And, and we've seen it. I have a picture hanging up on my wall where I'm shaking hands with Zhu Ranji, of all people, when he came to the CME back in, I don't know, 2001 or 2002. Okay. So it was, you know, it's political power. You know, listen, it's Mao's aphorism. All power grows out of the, all political power grows out of the barrel of a gun, right? That's one of Mao's, and his, Ezra Vogel wrote so beautifully about in his biography of Deng Xiaoping. You know, it was the Mao's, Deng Xiaoping had to live under, and it's being redone under Xi, the two whatevers, whatever Mao wanted and whatever Mao thought, right? The two whatevers. And it's not something that's, because again, it's tough. It's still, now we have something that they're China under Xi is a capitalist totalitarian. It's really probably the classic fascism, but I don't want to diminish Xi that much. I'll let him do that himself. But that's where we sit. And it's a question, you know, he thinks he can play to the world and play everybody off against each other. You know, I have my problems with China. Just, you know, remember what, 2-3 years ago when we used to only talk about how the Chinese were committing genocide against the Uyghurs? We haven't heard that discussion in maybe 4 years, 3 years, but it was, and I always admonish Iran, because Iran is supposedly the great protector of all things Islam. And who's the biggest traitor with China? Iran. So, you know, we all look past things, but, you know, those are two totalitarians speaking with other, and China, as much freedom as exists in China, there's still, as George knows and points out as well as anybody. And that goes back, you know, in 2003, I was on a panel with Dennis Gartman and some people, and we talked, I said, I don't pay attention to the data that comes out of China. Sorry, George, I know you were covering it. But, and my litmus test was, they didn't allow Google. And this is going back to 2003. They had already outlawed Google, 2004, I may be off a year. So there's no real free flow of data. So why should I trust it? My attitude was, I can watch Australia, New Zealand, everybody around them, and it'll tell me what's really going on in China. Because when those commodity markets are booming, they're booming for a reason. And they have a huge consumer called China.
Just a final question, George, on that article in the market. It was paraphrased as you mentioning the reserve status of the dollar can be an exorbitant privilege and an exorbitant burden for America at the same time. And you think that the U.S. still likes the idea that their control of the financial system gives them leverage. They are corroding it given their behavior at the moment, but it probably won't disappear very soon. Can you elaborate on that, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to do that. I'll try and do it sort of fairly briefly. I mean, I do think a couple of things. One is, I think a lot of conflation is going on between what I think is a dollar bear market. I mean, this is the fourth bear market we've had since the Bretton Woods system collapsed in the early 70s. And that on the one hand, and the threat to the dollar's kind of reserve currency structural status on the other. People conflate the two. In my judgment, maybe wrong, but in my judgment, I think what we're seeing is a bear market in the dollar, not a fundamental threat to its structural status. If for no other reason, that there simply is no, there's never been a parallel reserve or a similar reserve currency to the US dollar. And there isn't one waiting in the wings. So, you know, if we were to move to a kind of a more, what people call a multi-currency kind of reserve system, I think it's one in which the dollar will still hold sway, but there might be slightly larger roles to play for the euro, for other countries. Remember, the Bank of International Settlements has been kind of on top of this shift that's been going on for the last few years. And the gainers, to the extent that there have been gainers, Are the Aussie dollar, the Canadian dollar, the Swedish krona, to some degree, you know, the yen, Swiss franc, but not the renminbi, which is whose role and whose status has pretty much remained unchanged. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean that the Chinese and the Russians and the what we used to call the crinks, which is, you know, China, Russia, Iran and North Korea, but obviously there are a lot of countries in BRICS Plus that now kind of align with that a little bit. That doesn't mean to say that they won't and aren't incentivized to try and find alternative payment systems and invoice systems and swap systems to move away from the long arm of the US Treasury and the US financial system. You'd expect them to want to do that simply because they don't want to get, you know, crucified or caught in a dollar trap. But their ability to do that effectively is, I think, somewhat overstated and overhyped, largely because it doesn't really, in my view, it doesn't really matter who you invoice in what currency or who you get paid by in what currency. What really matters is how you accumulate balances or reserves in the final analysis. And so far, I don't think we have really very much evidence that even those countries that speak out most loudly against the dollar-based financial system are actually not continuing to accumulate dollar assets. So this is not to say that the American, you know, or the US dollar will reign supreme, you know, forever and a day. It's quite possible that a military shock or a huge kind of political shock or a debt crisis, you know, could undermine the viability of the dollar. The Mirren paper that everybody knows about, written by Steve Mirren when he was at Hudson Bay Capital last November, you know, is quite ambivalent about whether the American government should want, you know, the reserve currency status that it has. So things can change, but I just don't see it changing right now.
Mm-hmm. Those are great, insightful comments. Your final thoughts, Ira?
Well, this is why I've read George for so long, because, you know, I made my bones starting out in the FX markets, coming out of studying multinational corporations in the mid-70s, because I started in business in 77, but I had done graduate work on this. So these are all very important things. And of course, it was in the 60s, it was the French going after, as we know, and of course, Giscard d'Estaing, it's an exorbitant privilege. And that was from an imperialistic standpoint, that the United States was able to finance whatever it wanted to do and get away with everything when the French couldn't get away with anything and gotten their ass handed to them at DNB and Foo. And things didn't get any better. So when they had the ability to dump on the US, they did. And they called it an exorbitant privilege. But from a French imperialist standpoint, that was an exorbitant privilege. But of course, Pettus and George too, I believe, and a few others, but it's a burden. But that was Triffin and what's his name with the bonds in the 70s? Yes, I'm sorry, George.
Not Baker, was it? No, it wasn't.
No. You know, but, and again, who's missing in discussions here, going back to what we're talking about on July 9th, is, of course, Robert Lighthizer, who's probably the best mind of all of this. But now I know he went to work at Citibank as their trade analyst or somewhere of that nature. But he belongs in this conversation because we've seen this. And you know, every time dissent, and I have very great respect for Scott Bessent up to a point. He's disappointed over the last 6 or 7 weeks because he's more of a political animal than I imagined him to be. But you can talk about a strong dollar. But from my perspective, a strong dollar, that's a credibility that has to be earned. And when I look at this tax bill, you're not earning it because you have a 6.7% deficit with the full employment, as George talked about in his interview with the Swiss, but you have a 6.7% deficit. This is not a war economy. This is not an economy in recession. This is the danger of it. And we really haven't gotten into the global bond markets, but if I could sit with George, I think we would cover, that's an hour for sure as to where we're sitting here. And part of the dollar success is there's been no alternative. But if Christine Lagarde gets her way with Draghi, there will be a capital markets union before she takes the helm at the World Economic Forum. Europe needs a capital markets union in order to displace the dollar ever more. And that means fiscal harmonization, and that means surrendering sovereignty, which, you know, the court in the German constitutional court, well, this will be where it will be determined, in my estimation. But if that comes into being, the dollar then will have a legitimate competitor.
Correct. I'm not holding my breath, but you're right.
Well, great. That's a good note to end on. But it's been a great, insightful discussion. We thank you very much, George and Ira. And we'll continue the discussion at another time. As you said, we can probably go on for another hour or so. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. George, thanks, George.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.